Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy, episode 110 for July 14, 2011. Show and tell neck. Watch Autoline After Hours live at AutolineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline After Hours in the iTunes Store. Well, thanks for joining us here as we do this every Thursday night, folks. I usually give a shout out to my co-host, Peter DeLorenzo, but the bum's not here this night. He's out in Road America, bombing around the track, having a ball out there. And so good for Peter, and he'll be back here next week. But we've got Drew Winter from Ward's Auto World. Great having you here, Drew.
Great to be here, John.
And Todd Lassa from Motor Trend and Motor Trend Classic Magazine. Great having you here.
Thanks, John. Good to be here.
And then joining us later in the show, we've got Jack Telnack, the former head of design at the Ford Motor Company. We're going to have some great design discussion going here. But first, I got to go back to 2 weeks ago. We all took a vacation here at Autoline last week, so we were closed down. But as you'll all recall, we did the automotive fantasy draft 2 weeks ago. That was a great show. Man, we've gotten incredible amount of feedback on that thing. But as you'll remember, we also had a contest so that any of our viewers who happened to pick any of the executives that me or Peter DeLorenzo or Jim Hall or Ed Lapham chose, and we've got prizes to give out. So, do we have a drum roll?
Not ready.
Okay. And the grand prize winner is Glenn Ellsworth from Fort Edward, New York. He wins the grand prize, and there's a bunch of stuff. Listen to this. He gets two Chevy T-shirts, a Genesis Coupe Hot Wheels car, a Hyundai travel mug, a Hyundai all-weather jacket, and a die-cast model of the Chevrolet Volt. Second place went to Jarrett Henshaw from Ontario, Canada. Also got two Chevy T-shirts, a Genesis Coupe Hot Wheels car, a travel mug from Hyundai, and a Hyundai hoodie. And third place went to Mario Paredes from New York, New York. The kid's from the city, I can tell already. He got a couple of Chevy T-shirts, a Genesis Coupe Hot Wheels car. Derek Verstegen from Plainfield, Illinois. Hope I didn't butcher your last name too much there, Derek. Also got a couple of Chevy T-shirts and a Hot Wheels Genesis Coupe. And fifth place went to Victor Castaneda Jr. from Buckeye, Arizona. And Derek, or Victor, you get a couple of Chevy T-shirts. But anyway, thank all of you for participating in that. We will do the fantasy draft again at some point in the future because we had a lot of fun with it. But to my guys in the studio here, let's talk about some of the news that's going on right now. And the hot thing seems to be this CAFE standard. The Obama administration is proposing 56.2 miles per gallon. I don't know where the 0.2 came from, but that's the number that's being bandied about. Drew, what do you read into this?
Well, he's trying to I think, play to both sides. He's got to come up with a big number for his base to make them happy. They were pushing for 62, but he's also got to he's going to have to deal with the UAW and everyone else. The auto industry is going to say it's a job killer. So I think he's trying to play the middle there. We'll see how he does. But Carr came out. The Center for Automotive Research came out with a report that said at 62 miles per gallon that it was going to send what you're going to be looking at then. Cars were going to have to be like 71 miles per gallon, and then trucks were going to have to be in the 50s, and that was just basically going to kill off pickup trucks and other things. And they were forecasting hundreds of thousands of job losses simply because people were just going to stop buying cars.
And was that the $9,700 hike just for the technology? I think at that highest level, according to Carr, 62 miles per gallon. And I think it actually
thought it would add close to 10 grand to the price of a car.
Yeah, close to 10 grand. At the 56.2, and by the way, that those decimal marks are the result of the fact that you're looking at 35.5, and each step up recommended is a percentage per year, I believe, isn't it?
Yes,
a percentage
that's right.
Increase per year.
Right. Yeah.
So it comes out to exactly 56.2 if you do 5% per year from 2017 through 2025, and then 62 point something. Anyway, they're floating the second highest out of four different steps. The other thing, you know, it's the very confusing thing is that the mileage figures you get. You know, when you look at a CAFE number, it's not a CAFE number, right?
Right.
I mean, it's not just a direct. You have to be more than a mathematician to figure out exactly how it works. They have this
adjusted
numbers
and unadjusted numbers.
Exactly.
And yada, yada,
exactly.
Yada.
And the numbers are never quite as high as that.
These are not the adjusted numbers. So the real world fuel economy
would be lower.
Right.
But it's still going to be.
For trucks, it would have to be 29 mpg. I remember that number.
It's
still very
boggling. And the way they're selling it, I mean, they're selling it to voters and they do surveys of registered voters and people who don't buy cars. And they're all like, sure, yeah, I'd like to get 60 miles per gallon. And trying to sell it like this is going to be a benefit for consumers when the politicians don't. We're going to be doing a survey on this shortly to put some numbers on it as well. But the constituency out there doesn't understand the impact of the regulations. They have no clue of what 62 miles per gallon means, what kind of sacrifices. Our car is going to be less safe, or you're going to have to go to smaller cars. None of it. It's just a number they're throwing around.
They all talk about taking weight out of the cars as being, kind of the next kind of goal of getting better fuel mileage out of the cars. And this is on top of the fact that you also have still increasing standards, new roof crush standards,
right.
Pedestrian crash standards. But the other aspect of this, and not to support those 56.2 mile per hour per gallon goals, but if you look at what Europe's doing with CO2, I forget the exact correlation, Drew, maybe you know, but by 2016, the European standard will be pretty high. And if you think about the fact that the entire auto market is globalizing so much, except for pickup trucks, that's going to be the only really indigenous product you can buy at dealers here, 5 or 10 years from now. Everybody's looking at globalization. What will it take to coordinate all these different standards coming out of Europe, coming out of Japan, coming out of China potentially in the next 5 to 10 years anyway?
Well, and it's just crazy when you're trying to globalize and you're comparing. In Europe, you have a highly motivated consumer. When fuel is $8, $10 a gallon, they are motivated to buy a fuel-efficient vehicle.
Yeah.
Not so much motivation here when it's $3.50 or $4 a gallon.
Well, precisely. I mean, that's a great point in that you've got, in Europe, you have that high CO2 standard, but you've also had much higher fuel prices for many years, which has been driving the market for diesels especially and for, say, C cars instead of CD cars as being kind of the
I would even say A and B cars combined with turbo diesels.
Right. Well, I mean, the C car being kind of the mainstream family car in Europe, whereas it's a CD car here, mm-hmm. midsize here, compact there being the high volume segment.
Well, and plus you have things like CO2 taxes in Europe that incentivize things like stop start systems. So again, consumers will get a stop start system that will improve fuel economy. Here, stop start systems don't even show up on the EPA
There's no
test
benefit.
Cycle.
Right.
There's no benefit. So here
no,
you have
no laboratory benefit.
Yeah.
There is real
there,
world.
There is real benefit.
Right.
But then, so again, we have antiquated government rules and tests that are, you know, they're setting standards super high at one end, and then they're not offering any sort of incentive or changes to an ancient regulatory system that might encourage more fuel-saving technology, such as stop-start systems, which they're all over Europe. They could bring them in. It's very low cost, but so many automakers are saying, you know, why should we do it? We get no benefit.
Yeah. They will do it, though. They will do it. Before the decade's out, it's going to be on just about everything in the U.S. market.
There must be a push to get that into the EPA cycle, though, because, you know, all these studies I've seen, including the CAR study, assumes that by the end of the decade, you're going to see more stop-start. But if you've ever driven it, you know, it's funny. I drove one in – I drove a stop-start version of the BMW X3, which I drove in the States for its launch, but the launch, you know, starting in the South and South Carolina and Atlanta, because the factory's in South Carolina, the first ones off the line were the Euro Market X3s. So they gave us the stop start, and they were obviously looking to see what kind of reaction we'd have. And I could see where there's a lot of concern if you're a luxury brand to have that kind of stop start in a $40,000 or $50,000 or $60,000 car or sport utility vehicle that the buyer is probably going to ding the company in the J.D. Power numbers, saying, "Oh, this thing is really, you know, not very smooth when you take off." Then you've got the button that can turn it off anyway, and how many people are going to do that? So.
Well, another thing that came out this week, of course, is that the Detroit 3 automakers are powwowing with the UAW over this, because they know the UAW has a direct line right into the White House. They know that the president will listen to concerns of labor, and the union's got to be concerned about job losses, because 56.2 miles per gallon is going to hurt, especially the truck market, where the Detroit 3 are strong.
Well, again,
so I find it fascinating that here's one advantage of having a union that the transplants don't have.
Yeah, I mean, the CAR study was talking about literally hundreds of thousands of jobs being lost as people simply stopped buying new vehicles. And, you know, if Obama's first priority is jobs, then he has to take, again, this tough position against his own constituency and saying, jobs are more important than climate change right now. So, look, we're going to back off on the fuel economy. I mean, I think that's the only way he can do it. And then, of course, he's going to get lots of
he'll take a lot of heat.
Yeah, he's going to take
no matter
a lot
what
of
he
heat.
Does, he's going to take a lot of heat.
Yeah.
So, also very interesting, speaking of VW, is it was castigated by General Motors today, that put out a release saying, how dare you, Martin Winterkorn, CEO of Volkswagen, talk about a potential sale of Opel going to the Chinese. Keep your big trap shut is essentially what the thing was saying. What did you guys read into that?
Well, I mean, you know, that's kind of life in the big city, isn't it? I mean, I think public, I mean, you know, this kind of stuff goes on behind the scenes all the time. But yeah, I think to come out publicly and just, you know, just really try to undercut an automaker, I mean, or a competitor, is that's got to sting.
It's funny, when the whole issue came up a few weeks ago, and it was, I think Der Spiegel perhaps was the first to report it, that GM may be looking at selling Opel again. And this was after, you know, and we've been all through the back and forth when GM was going to sell part of Opel as a result of the bankruptcy a couple of years ago. And then it looked a lot smarter to hold on to it because, you know, what was Chrysler's biggest problem in the last 20 or 30 years? It's that it had no presence in Europe. Well, so now GM's holding on to Opel, and then a few weeks ago the reports come out that GM may be looking to sell Opel again. And the blame I had heard goes directly to Der Spiegel, which doesn't like General Motors very much, and the German government similarly. It seemed like the GM statement this week was trying to make it sound like Winterkorn's statements started this several weeks ago, although Winterkorn, his people responded by saying, well, he was just responding to a reporter, maybe it was a Der Spiegel reporter, asking him what he thought about selling Opel. His comment was, well, he didn't think that Hyundai would go after it, but maybe a Chinese company would. And
maybe it was an offhand remark. You know, if you look at Steve Rattner's book, who you know, the cars are,
yeah,
went through a lot of that stuff in detail, and I went through his book again and found a couple of clear passages there where he said that the reason they didn't want to sell Opel back 2 years ago or whenever was they thought it was way underpriced. Mm-hmm. They just thought this is just way too cheap. Mm-hmm. And the CEO of what was Ed Whitaker at that time said, look, guys, let's just hold tight on this and wait a couple of years until the price goes up, until the economy improves, until we can get more money for this thing, and then let's try to sell it. Well, lo and behold, 2 years passes, and suddenly we're hearing these rumors. So I think that's what's happening.
Well, the thing about Opel is that there are two ways to fix it if you hold on to it. One is to increase volume. The other is to increase the average transaction prices on the cars and to kind of bring back the kind of status that Opel had in the 60s or 70s when it was truly a German Buick. And that's kind of how they're trying to position Opel now. GM's talking about how Chevrolet is becoming its international brand and that it's going to become big in Europe, which would make, and it's also trying to internationalize Cadillac again, which again would put Opel precisely where Buick is in the United States. But those are big, big problems to overcome. The other interesting thing is that, you know, Ackerson apparently didn't like what Winterkorn was saying about his company, and there's a little bit of you know, getting back what you put out. I mean, if you consider what Ackerson said about Lincoln a few weeks ago, that Lincoln.
Well, not only that, he's trashed Toyota and Mercedes. So I mean,
you know, you learn in this business very quickly that if you work for one of the companies, and even the PR people will tell you this, they'll say, you know, if someone's having trouble with whatever recalls or quality issues or making money or whatever, you don't trash them if you're a competitor.
You say there, but because, for the grace of
right,
God,
and that's
it will come back and hit you, and it has hit Ackerson.
Right, because everybody gets their turn in the barrel, mm-hmm. you know, in this town, and that's always been the standing rule, as I know it, was, hey, you know, it's going to be you in a couple of years, so you better keep your mouth shut.
And here's an outsider who worked for, cell phone company, right? And that there they don't mind trashing each other. That's kind of the way of doing business.
Yeah.
Hey, this is a good place to take a break. We need to take a commercial break and then get Jack Telnak up on here. So, Ben, let's thank our friends at Hyundai. The sixth generation of the Hyundai Sonata is taking the industry by storm, and no wonder. It offers a fluidic design theme that gives it a strikingly modern, coupe-like exterior design, and yet the interior provides the roominess of a full-size car as measured by the EPA. The Sonata also provides an eco-friendly interior with soy-based foam for the seats. Put it all together with Hyundai's strong reliability and value proposition, and you've got yourself a really compelling package. Check it all out at HyundaiSonata.com. Jack Telnak, the former vice president of design for the Ford Motor Company. It's great having you here, Jack.
It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me, John.
I mean, you've seen all kinds of changes in this business.
Well, I've only been in it for 40. I was only in it for 40 years.
In fact, one thing that I find fascinating is you were born and raised in Dearborn, right?
Exactly, yes.
You're the only person I know, I think, in the entire industry who was actually born in a town where the company was headquartered and went all the way to the top in the profession.
Well, it's beyond that, too, because I don't know if I ever mentioned this to you, but I was actually born in the Ford Hospital.
I mean, perfect is that?
Yeah, really. I mean, I couldn't draw a Chevy if I tried. They actually said I came out with a Ford Oval stamped on me as a baby, but it worked out very well. And I had a Ford scholarship out in California, too, and they hired me right out of school.
So you went to Art Center in Pasadena?
College. Right, yeah. Uh-huh. And I can still remember as a kid, as a 16-year-old, I'd be sitting on the serpentine wall at the Ford test track in Dearborn.
Which is still there today, the brick wall.
Still there. And we'd go out after school and just see what they were testing out there, and couldn't wait to run back to school the next morning and tell all our buddies, hey, I saw that new 52 Ford, I think it was a 52 with a clear plastic roof on it. And it was really exciting things back in those days. So it had to.
They don't let anybody sit on the wall these
not
days.
Not anymore. No, I'm sure they don't.
But my father used to. People with shotguns that take care of that.
Oh, really? But my father used to take me to the old Ford Rotunda. You remember
that? I remember the Rotunda.
It came from the Chicago Fair that Henry Ford brought back in. And I remember I was 4 years old and being in there seeing the 1941 Lincoln Continental. Still remember the car, burgundy with a tan convertible top, three-quarter top on it, and I just fell in love with that car. Unfortunately, my father couldn't afford one. He had bought a burgundy 41 Ford instead of the Continental, but I think it had a very strong impact on me and certainly gave me a direction for my life.
The Rotunda actually had an impact on me because I remember at Christmas time, they always did some big shindig there.
Sure.
And, I mean, I was extremely young. I must have been 4 or 5 years old at the time. But they had sort of Ford's vision of the future, this very sort of futuristic city with cars running around. And, I mean, I was just blown away by it.
Oh, it was great.
And then the place burned to the ground. I remember being shocked as a little kid that the Rotunda was gone.
I had tears in my eyes. Because I used to drive past it every evening on the way home from the design center. And I can still remember the smoldering ashes and the limestone structure that just collapsed in there. It was very traumatic for me. It really was because I spent a lot of time there. I used to go out there as a kid during World War II when they stopped the displays because it was all the Rotunda was converted to an office building for war work.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. And I can remember riding my bike there and walking inside and walking around the whole Rotunda to see if there was still some car displays. And all there were desks and people in there working for the war effort. And I just knew, you know, someday there had to be cars coming back in. And I think they finally reopened it around, maybe 52 or 53 and started the displays back again, which I was thrilled about.
And that was right across the street from the original Ford Motor Company headquarters,
exactly.
Which was this very beautiful, I think, Italianate building with the red tile roof.
Exactly,
and that's gone.
Yeah.
In fact, there's no trace of that building ever having been there before.
Right. Yeah, that was right on the edge of the Ford Rouge complex.
Right.
Yeah, on Schaefer Road, yeah.
And I knew that because I worked at the Rouge one summer. And
so did I.
That's where I got me an education. I learned a whole lot in that place.
I spent one summer in the glass plant there.
Well, I worked in the steel mill and the hot bar mill.
Oh, great. Well, I remember when I was there, it was in 55 because they were building the 55 T-Birds on the same line with the 55 Fords. And it was just so much fun. I would have time in between breaks and all to run over the main production line and see them coming down the line. And in those days, that was pretty exciting with all the wild color combinations they had.
So what got you into design?
I don't know.
Well, I mean, obviously you had been thinking about it.
You went to art center, you were thinking about this way early. Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was always drawing cars as a kid in school, and I knew I either wanted to get into automotive design or architecture, and the automotive really got me. And the strangest part about it is here I'm born and raised in Detroit, and all the big three are in Detroit, and there were really no design schools in Detroit. I had to go all the way to California. Not then, no. And I remember my dad set me up with an appointment to meet some design people at Ford, and I went over and met Alex Tremulous, who was
kidding.
Oh, yeah. And Alex was the guy who designed the Tucker and Duesenbergs, Kaiser Fraser, if you remember those.
Yes.
And he was running the advanced studio at Ford at the time. I also met some people over at GM. I met Homer Lagasse at GM.
Oh, I remember Homer, because he later taught at CCS.
Yes. Oh, yeah. And he joined us at Ford later on. But I saw him at GM in the old GM Design Center, just off West Grand Boulevard.
Mm-hmm.
But
which is now part of CCS.
Right. What a great place to. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's a really nice setup. But Alex told me, he said, well, look, kid, if you want to get in this business, I brought in a couple of little sketches. He said, you really have to perfect this a little bit. And he recommended the Art Center in California. It was in Los Angeles at the time. Now it's in
Pasadena,
of course. But and I did, and I came back, and as a matter of fact, Alex came out there and hired me, and I said, this is it. So he really gave me some great direction on that, and then I worked for him in the Ford Advance Studio, and I joined them in 1958. When we were working, the first project I worked on was the 60 Ford,
Now, if I remember right, I thought you told me a long time ago you did like the taillight bezel or something like that.
Yeah, I did. That's probably, we were doing grill textures and taillight bezels and all those sorts of details. And but yeah, that was a very exciting time to get in the automobile business.
Sure, that was, you know, when America had this can-do attitude.
Oh,
can do anything.
Absolutely. No feasibility problems. There were no crash requirements, no, just...
An annual styling change, so everything was getting changed every year.
It was amazing. I was just talking to a friend of mine about that today because we were talking about the 60 Ford and how it changed from 59 to 60, and it was really influenced back then by the 59 Chevy.
Impala?
Impala, with the
cat-eye taillights,
yeah,
and the wings practically off
of that. Horizontal.
Still one of the most beautiful cars,
I think. Yeah, they did a great job on that. And I understand when Ford saw that, that inspired the 64. We say, hey, we better get on the ball, because the 59 was very boxy, and so it was a total departure from that when they got into the 60. And the 60, by the way, was the widest American vehicle ever built. I'm not sure. I think it was 72 inches wide. Really.
Wow.
As I understand,
some cars are not even that long.
I know, really. And they actually, I understand, I haven't seen it, but they said in Tennessee it was so wide that they actually put running lights on the backs of the fin, the horizontal fins that were on there, because that was the widest point of the car, the tailing edge of the fin back there.
Wow.
And they required that in Tennessee. So I never saw one, but they said they did that.
So you're competing with Chevy and Pontiac, right? I mean, the wide track Pontiac probably.
Yeah, well, back in those days, we didn't know what wide track was, I think.
Okay.
Well, that was, DeLorean's, marketing genius. Knudsen, I should say, put a stamp on it. Hey, if we're going to make them wide, let's market the fact.
Yeah, and it was good. But they were the first ones, one of the first to get the proper tread to sheet metal relationship.
Yeah.
So we eliminated overhang, and I mean lateral overhang on the side of the cars. It was where the wheels were always tucked under, and nobody noticed it back in those days.
Well,
really figured it out.
The easiest way to notice that is if you see a Canadian Pontiac from that era, because they were built on the Chevy chassis, and they don't have that relationship.
That's right.
So if you could park one of those next to a similar American version. But that's the competitor we should be talking about.
Yeah, that's right.
But it was easier to do those faster turnarounds back then, right? Because you only had a handful of cars. You had all these guys,
well,
and you had
not even a handful.
This is it. We didn't have the full line of cars, and it was just sheet metal. We weren't changing the underbodies and the frames. So, it was no problem at all.
But that's an advantage of body on frame.
It was. And matter of fact, that 64, hey, keep talking about the 64, but it was an 18-month project. You don't do a car in 18 months today.
Listen,
you really could in those days.
But there was a great-looking Ford that really stands out in that era.
It was a dramatic departure from anything else in the industry. Very fast windshield on it. And that chrome line that went from the front fender all the way back to the low horizontal fin on the tail of the car is a very clean car.
Yeah.
It wasn't that well-received in the marketplace, I think. It wasn't bad, but we immediately changed then for 61. All new sheet metal again in 61. Went back to the round taillights because everybody said a Ford had to have round taillights.
Mm-hmm. It's funny you say 18-month car, because today, and I'm not exaggerating at all, if you want to change tires on a car, I don't mean like us getting out and changing the spare. I mean, as a program manager, if you go, I want to change these tires, 18 months. To do all the durability and go through purchasing and blah, 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 blah.
Well, and just
18
all the
months
design
just to change the tires on a car.
Well, the design parameters and all the jounce effects and everything you have to, and all the restrictions on that, which we've really gotten around because there were so many old rules that we had to go by until we said, well, wait a minute, BMW and the Europeans are getting this great tread and great stance of the cars. Why can't we? Well, they have rounder flanges on them. Well, can't we make rounder flanges on our fenders to accommodate that so we don't cut our tires on them? But I learned a lot, again, when I was 16 about basic body, because although I liked the 41 Continental, I could never afford one as a kid, but I eventually bought a 41 Mercury convertible and chopped and channeled it, got my torches down at a pawn shop on Michigan Avenue for $20. As a matter of fact, I still have one mounted on a plaque that the guys gave me back at the company when I retired, and took 6 inches out of the firewall of the car and lowered the whole body on the frame, and I could only get the seat down so far, so when I lowered the steering column, the steering wheel, it would rub on my pant leg. As a matter of fact, I drove it to California to school at 16. Well, 17, sorry. It took 17 by the time I finished. I actually wore a hole in my pant leg from the steering wheel, but I was cool. It had a three-quarter white Carson top on it and naturally prime paint, metallic prime paint, I might add. It was always a little bit advanced there, too.
What do you think Continental needs or Lincoln needs to do now? I mean, it's Cadillac has made it's yeah. it's created a new design vocabulary. It's really recreated itself. It seems like Lincoln's still struggling. What can it do, or what do you think it needs to do?
I think they could really use a new mark, maybe the Mark 9, to get it started. A good hot two-door mark to bring some traffic into the showroom. They've got some great product coming out. I've been over to the design center recently, but I would really vote for a mark. I think a mark would set that place on fire.
Just to set the tone for where they got to take the brand.
Get the halo effect over the whole brand. Get that going first, because there's so many wonderful design cues that we have on the mark that can be used in a new contemporary interpretation of the mark. And I think that would really set the stage for it. So it's something to talk about. Get some real attention focused on the car, on the whole line, on the whole Lincoln line.
But, it seems to me that, every 4 or 5 years, Ford appoints a new design director for Lincoln, and that designer wants to take them in this direction, and it never works for whatever reasons. It may not even be the designer's fault.
Yeah.
And then, oh, no, that didn't work. Now we got to go charging down in another direction. How do you set a long-term vision? Cadillac seems to have it. And even
the
new CTS or the current CTS is very different from the original one, you still go, yeah, but that's a CTS.
Because you can't hold a theme. I think you have to develop a theme and then stick with it and evolve it. And I think that Lincoln hasn't been doing that. They've been jumping a little bit and trying new design approaches, and they really have to hold on to the theme. And this happens with a lot of different car lines. But once you have the strong graphics on the car, work with it, evolve it, and do contemporary interpretations of it.
What kind of graphics does it need? What would you do?
Well, I would go back to I don't know exactly what I would do. First off, I think that the split bow weight grill that they have on a Lincoln now is dramatic. But I think it can be refined. I think you'll see that some of the new versions coming out will be a refinement of that. And it's a very strong Lincoln feature.
Good. Oh, so they're revolving it, not just throwing it away.
Right. Yes. And based on what I saw recently, yes. And that's Lincoln. Nobody else can do that. They own that. And hold on to it and develop it. And you can work with different proportions on it, but you know that it does work. And I think they're... I would like to see if I was doing an all-new Lincoln, say a new town car, if you will, reduced in size, of course, I'd love to go back to, say, the 61 Continental with the slab sides, which doesn't sound good, but, I mean, it's very dramatic. It was a very elegant, one of the most elegant Lincolns ever built, in my opinion. And I could see doing a number of variations on that theme. And it's Lincoln, and everybody would know it's a Lincoln.
The 64... I think it is the convertible Lincoln, 64 Lincoln convertible. I think that was like with the suicide door.
Four-door, with suicide doors.
61.
Yeah. Okay. That was one of my favorite cars of all time.
Yeah, matter of fact, at the Detroit Auto Show this year, there must have been a half a dozen 61 Lincoln customs there. I don't know if you noticed that.
Yeah. They're very hot these days.
They were gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous. I mean, it's easy to do. I mean, if I was there, I think I'd sure take a shot at that.
But is there a way to do that sort of design and yet retain the 41 style grill? Because the problem is Lincoln actually just before that grill had tried on some of its models a kind of 1961 style grill.
Yes.
And it's almost
it's too clean, it doesn't work with modern design. Script. It didn't say much. Yeah.
So could you combine that current grill style?
That's a
good
thought. I'd like to have a shot at that, yeah. And one of the nice parts about the 61, too, it was a very airfoil front end on it, and so was the 61 T-Bird. And very modern, and, you could work that again, especially with all the new... we could even meet the bumper restrictions with that, and with all the new technology that's available to us today, you could do that.
Well, the other question, though, about the current times, that you were leading Ford design when everybody was heading toward front-wheel drive.
Yes.
I mean, even the Mustang was going to be front-wheel drive. It became the Probe instead.
That was close.
That was very
was close.
I hear it's very close.
Yes.
Right. So can you do how important is the dash to axle relationship, and does Lincoln, in doing, say, a new Mark 9, does it need to be on a rear drive platform? Can they do it front wheel drive? What do you think there?
I think you could. Well, I would go all-wheel drive, and I think this dash to axle relationship is very key in the overall proportioning of the car. But even more important than that is the height of the cowl, especially if you want platform flexibility. You know, everybody talks about platform flexibility today in the industry. That isn't anything new. Do you know how many cars we got off platforms in the Ford Motor Company these years? You know,
The Mustang came off the Falcon.
The Mustang came off the Falcon, and then the later Mustang, we got the 79 Mustang, came off the Fairmont.
Right.
We took a Lincoln, we took a T-Bird, we took a Cougar off it. This isn't anything new. We've been doing that for years. But we can still get some great length.
But cowl height, you say, is critical.
If I want platform flexibility, my theory back there when I was designing cars was, hey guys, and working with the engineers, give me a low cowl and I'll give you a hot car. I can always raise the cowl if I want to do a larger sedan or an SUV off it or anything like that. But I can never bring the cowl down once it's locked in. Yeah. It's the most expensive part
point.
Of the car.
It is a hard point.
You're locked in. You can't do anything with it.
That's the problem with the Dodge Challengers, that they had to go with the high cowl that the 300 and the Dodge Charger have.
Sure.
And so the Challenger's way longer, way bigger than a Ford Mustang or even a Chevy Camaro, because they had to get the proportions right. If they're using that high cowl otherwise, it would be a stubby-looking car.
So. Hey, time out. We got to take a quick commercial break here, and then we'll get back to this discussion. Ben, we got to thank our friends at Bridgestone right now. Bridgestone is featuring its third generation of run-flat tires with groundbreaking new technology. Current run-flat tires can offer peace of mind for consumers, but the added mass and the stiffer sidewalls can compromise ride comfort and fuel efficiency. The new third-generation Bridgestone run-flat tires reduce heat and improve performance and ride comfort. Whether you're a program manager in the industry or just looking for a set for your personal car, check it out at BridgestoneTire.com. So I thought Todd raised a really good point, front drive versus rear drive.
Yes.
I can't see Lincoln ever getting to be taken seriously if it only does front drive. And I'm not sure even all-wheel drive is the answer to get the right proportions on a car.
Well, I think we could get the proportions with, I believe we could get the right proportions with all-wheel drive. And proportion is key to the whole equation here. That's all there is to it. You know, there are three basic ingredients on a car. If you want a hot car, proportion. But we could do it with front or wheel. But I would go for all-wheel drive, because let's bring it up with the big guys now and be more global with this car and much more sophisticated with all-wheel drive. But again, start with a cowl, start with dash to front axle. And work the pack.
At low cowl.
Low cowl. However, I will admit, because the guys will kill me. They would have killed me back then, because I was always preaching, lower the cowl. Give me a low cowl, I'll give you a hot car. On the 79 Mustang, we actually had to raise the cowl a little bit, maybe an inch and a half, 2 inches, just to get some slope to the hood, because we're working I know it sounds sacrilegious.
It was the Fairmont.
It was a Fairmont cowl, so we had to raise it just to get some slope. And we pulled the windshield as far forward as we could get it, and then we faked it a little bit with a blacked-out cowl air intake area just to make it look as if it was a faster windshield. But it worked, because the 79 Mustang was really...
It saved the Mustang.
It saved Mustang, and it was the first aero attempt that we ever had at doing cars. We had a slope back front end on the car, and it was people, when it first came out, thought it was a very European effect.
Well, you
and
had just gotten back from Europe, right?
I just got back from Europe when we did the cars, and I can remember walking in the studio, because I had the Mustangs in one of the studios that I had then, and we were just starting on the program, and the guys had a whole board full of sketches there, and they said, well, which one do you want, Mr. Telnak? And I said, no, which one do you want? You're the designers. Which ones are you really excited about? I'll go away. I'll come back in another day or so. And then you tell me which ones you have them. These are all your sketches on this wall. Tell me which ones you want. And that's how we selected the 79 Mustang. One of the guys had it. And then when these were sketches, and then they blew it up to full size, and they lost it. And I said, wait a minute, what are you doing? They said, well, because manufacturing wants this, and they want the cowl and the belt line to slope this way. And I said, well, no. And I said, just take that sketch and blow it up full size and retain everything that you have on there and hold all the excitement that you had in that. And they did it, and that's how the car started. And that was a tough job on a Fairmont platform.
Right.
It really was. But the car worked. It really worked for us.
Before we run out of time, I want to ask you some aero questions.
And he's asking that because on the cover of this month's Wards is a big question about aerodynamics killing styling.
Yeah, and we do these stories apparently every few years because I interviewed you for the same story about 15 years ago.
I remember that.
You
right.
gave me a tremendous quote back then where you said, "Look, birds are aerodynamic, right. and nobody has trouble distinguishing an eagle from a canary."
Right, they can all fly.
Yeah. Great quote. But my concern, we were talking here earlier about fuel economy, you know, a 60 MPG fuel economy.
Right.
I mean, it sounds like we're heading for all canaries here, you know. I mean, is it possible if we're really talking about cars getting 50, 60, 70 miles per gallon, trucks getting 50 miles per gallon, are they? Can you really differentiate them, or are they going to all start to look like, you know, different sized Camrys?
I believe.
Or Priuses.
Fair enough. I believe aero has never been a restriction for me. As a matter of fact, aero gave us, and I really got into aero when I was in Europe for 4 years running our studios over there. Because we were much more concerned about fuel economy in Europe back in those days. I think aero gives us a lot of freedom. It gives a designer a real impetus to it's the only chance a designer has to make a real honest contribution to fuel economy. Because if we bend the sheet metal more efficiently, we can do it. And nobody can argue with it. And it gives us a rationale for the design of the car. But because of this bird, the canary and eagle comparison, no, there's an incredible amount of flexibility and freedom there in design. And it's a matter of working with the engineers in a collaborative way to develop it and make the design work and meet all the aero requirements. And fine, if I can make a contribution to fuel economy, we'll do it. But I think we can get the differential. I've never had a problem with aero. And one of the important points here is we got so involved with aero in design that we control aero design. The design center control aero in the Ford Motor Company. The aerodynamics people were
right.
working for us.
That, right.
I shouldn't say for. They were working with us.
Uh-huh.
It was a collaborative effort again, and it really helped us. And I think the 79 Mustang was a good example. That was the first slant back front end that we had in Ford. It was aero. Then that worked us into the 83. T-Bird, which was a very aero-looking car. And it wasn't just looking aero, but it was aero. And we convinced management that aero was saleable. By the way, we had aero way back with the Lincoln Zephyrs in the Ford Motor Company.
Uh-huh.
But we wouldn't advertise aero back then because Chrysler had the airflow before we did, and it had a negative connotation.
No.
So
the airflow didn't sell well.
Yeah,
that's
It didn't sell well. Yeah,
it didn't look all that good.
Visually, it wasn't that good. It wasn't an exciting car. The emotion wasn't there. It was the wrong kind of emotion with
yeah.
the car. But, and so we had our Lincoln Zephyr. I wasn't there at the time. I want to make this
yeah.
point. It was 1937. But our Lincoln Zephyr was more aerodynamic than that, but we wouldn't tell anybody about it. This is the way the word goes. But after that, so we got the Mustang, the 79 Mustang, the 83 T-Bird, and that really paved the way for the Taurus. And then we went all out for aero. And our management was convinced at that time, hey, aero does sell. And we had to sell management on it first before they'd go that way. But at the time when we did the Taurus, Phil Caldwell was running the company, and we were losing millions of dollars.
Millions is kind.
Yeah, right. And I can still remember Phil coming into the studio as we were developing the clay models of the Taurus. This was the 86 Taurus. And asking us, and he was not necessarily a car guy. He was more of a finance guy, but, you know, a great manager. And he would come to us and say, do you really think you've reached far enough? I mean, normally
he's pushing
top that. Management would come
Daily.
In and say, hold it, you've gone
right.
too
yeah.
far with this.
Yeah.
Pull this design back a little bit. And he would push us even more. But I think he had the confidence in us because I worked with Phil over in Europe, and we had some successes in Europe with the Granadas and some of the cars we were doing over there with aero. And he believed in us. He trusted us, and he was able to do it.
Well, and then you had already the T-Bird under your belt, and what was it, the Mark IV,
II? Yeah.
Which
yeah.
was?
Oh, I'm glad you mentioned that, because it was that was the Mark VII, the Mark VII.
Okay.
Yeah, then we got the...
Yeah, what am I thinking?
Mark IV
was back in the 60s.
Yeah, right. The Mark VII, well, can I tell you just a little story about that?
Yeah.
When we were doing the T-Bird, we were going through market research. I wasn't a great advocate or a fan of market research. I told our market research guys it was a black art, and they really hated me for that. But anyway... I could talk about research.
Well, you're right. Yeah, we.
yeah. But we were showing. We had some research right at the in our rotunda at the design center, and we had several T-Birds there. This is for the 83 T-Bird, but they were all very boxy. We just couldn't get out of there. But we were already started on the Mark VII, and So the research was going no place. People were just really disappointed in it. And I said, hey, hang on just a minute. Let's get, and I told the guy, bring the Mark 7 out here, take the hood ornament off it, and turn the car in a three-quarter front view so he couldn't see the tire on the rear deck, the tire shape on the rear deck. Roll that car in. We rolled it in, and the respondents just leapt out of their chairs. They said, yeah, that's a T-Bird. And it had a slightly slanted grill on the thing and all. And so that really started the 83 T-Bird. Mm-hmm. And the doors and the roof, the whole body central was very similar. And that kicked off the program. That's when we got out of the box. You look at the T-Bird. So the Mark helped us on that.
The market research, though, must have been what had Ford keep the LTD2 around for a couple of years after the Taurus. Because even though they were you guys were pretty groundbreaking with that car. Someone in management must have said, well, we better keep the old-style car around just in case.
I think there may have been some cost issues and investment issues walking around there, too. They just didn't want to put the money in to change it at that time.
Okay.
And then when they finally got around to it, we went much softer on it. But, yeah, that kind of stood out.
So everybody remembers the first Taurus as this enormous success, but it actually started out kind of slow. People were at first kind of scared of it.
It was
right?
Very controversial.
Very controversial, yeah. And I can remember our competitors across town, matter of fact, Lee Iacocca, was saying things like, well, here they're doing those jelly bean cars and potato shapes and all this sort of thing. And all I would say is, hey, hang on. I said, you guys are going to follow us. You'll just watch. And you know, when we market researched that car, it was off to a slow start in market research. And the research people were really nervous about it. As a matter of fact, we had just a clean front end with a floating oval. We had no grill texture on the car.
Yeah.
And we actually had to go through an exercise in market research for the marketing people with a grill texture on the front of the Taurus. And it went through the research, and it didn't do too much. But the man who made the final decision on that, whether we did the clean front end or the grill texture, was Bill Ford.
Really?
And Bill Ford. And okay. I'll never forget that meeting. You know, we sat in there, and everybody was kind of tensed up and waiting for that final decision because he had the final say-so on the cars mm-hmm. back then. And he said, yeah, I like that one. I about leapt out of my seat and kissed him. I said, boy, you had his spot. But he always had an eye for design. He really did. He knew. He just had that second sense.
That's interesting.
Well, that's right, because people worried about the engine would be cooled without the slats and all sorts of crazy
you
stuff.
You've got to have a grill. No,
yeah.
You don't.
But the whole car was done well. And Lou Veraldi, of course, ran that program and did a brilliant job of it.
The sun rises and sets on Lou Veraldi. Well, unfortunately, it really set this time. He's no longer with us. But Lou and I worked together in Europe on the first Ford Fiesta.
Mm-hmm.
And that Lou was the kind of an engineer that just walked through walls. He just made it happen. We spoke the same language. When it came time to do the Taurus, we said, we that's where we really got great stance to the car. We got those wheels out to the sheet metal and flush side glass on the car,
which
was
that.
Always impossible to do. We were the first ones here to do it. And people said, but Lou just told the engineers, just do it.
And there was one other thing, too. You guys did a station wagon version of it.
Oh,
and you did
a
separate body side aperture so that you could get the back doors and the proportions right. And even did a second rear suspension just for the wagon.
Just for the wagon, yes.
Which nobody would do these days. Not in this town.
Yeah. But it really sold, and it was exciting. And I'll never forget when we introduced that car in Los Angeles, and Caldwell was just getting ready to retire, so we introduced it just before he retired on a soundstage in California. I don't know if you were out there.
I was not there, but I heard all about it.
It was the most spectacular.
Over the top.
It was over the top, yeah. We had three turntables up on a platform draped with circular drapes around them, and the lights came on, and the music started, and they raised the curtains, and the car started spinning, and the people came up. All the media people were in there walking over the stage, and then down into the dining room for dinner. It was all done in a space theme. I mean, it was spectacular. It really was. But it was it worked.
Hey, we got to take another commercial break here, and then we're going to come back and do rapid fire and get some of the questions from the audience here. But Ben, now we've got to thank our friends at Chevrolet. The Chevrolet Cruze is the car that is taking the world by storm, and a key reason is all the equipment that it offers: a driver information center, a USB port, ambient LED backlighting on the dashboard, remote start with a MyLink app, two accessory power outlets, one in front and one in the back for the rear passengers, OnStar, turn-by-turn directions free for the first 6 months. Whew, there's just too much to list here. And you can check it all out at Chevrolet.com/cruise. Okay, it's time to get to rapid fire. Ben, let's bring that up. My favorite part is when you hear the shell casing start to hit the floor. That's my best part of rapid fire. Okay, the first question comes from Oak Cabin 44. He says, please ask Jack why car designers put the gas fuel filler neck on the right rear corner of a car. Everyone that has it hates it. You have to walk around the car to fill the tank, and it's hard to get to many gas pumps.
We've had them on the rear of the car. We've had them on the right side, on the left side. They're on. I can't tell you exactly why they're on the right side at the moment. But
Is there any rhyme or reason or rules or regulations? Or
no, I tend to agree with them because I always have to walk around to the other side of the car to put fuel in my car now. I think probably one of the best gas filler caps, so if I may, was on Cadillac when they had it underneath the taillight. You pressed a button and put it under the taillight. I don't know if you ever heard the story of how that happened.
No.
Well, they said Harley Earl was showing a clay model of a Cadillac. I think it was probably about maybe 41 or 42, someplace around there. And he forgot to scribe in an area for the gas cap, the filler door. And one of the top guys in the company said, well, where's the filler on this car? And he was quick enough to say, it's under the taillight. And he said, well, how would you do that? He said, we just press this reflex button. And boy, right away, he got the modelers to work on it. And the next day, he was able to show a gas cap under there. But it was just because somebody asked the question, and that's how it happened, which I thought was kind of...
That is a great story. Will asks, how does wind noise relate to aerodynamics and styling? For example, does wind noise tend to be the result of emphasizing styling over aerodynamics?
No, I really believe that styling and aerodynamics, or design and aerodynamics, work together, and we're always working to reduce wind noise. So we don't cause wind noise. We try to eliminate wind noise with design, with proper design.
DC Auto Geek says, let's get to the real question. What do you know about where Lincoln is headed? If you know nothing, where would you take them?
Well, we talked about that a little bit in the program, and I'd still go for probably a Mark 9 and just a great four-door sedan, and I would see a strong influence of the 61 Lincoln in that if I had a chance to get at that again. A contemporary version of it, of course.
KJ Cujo asks, when people say, I had a 57 Chevy or a 57 Ford, what are they referring to? Bel Air? Fairlane?
Yeah, and those I've always supported Ford on that, but I will admit that the 57 Chevy Bel Air was a great looking car also. Yeah, and they seem to be holding up well now. And
Ford outsold Chevy that year.
We did outsell them. We had probably more drama to our car.
Yeah,
but I've got to be honest. I think the Chevy then was a cleaner car, and it has more lasting value.
But the Bel Air was just a trim level, wasn't it?
Well, it was a trim level. Yeah, but
they only had one body style.
Right, one body style.
Yeah, right,
but
yeah.
The same would have been for Fairlane. Fairlane was a trim level,
Okay,
I think that's what he's getting at.
Okay.
Goggles Pisano says, what do you think of the 1974 to 78 Mustang II design?
I try not
you
to.
You were in Europe.
I tried.
I was out of town. It wasn't me.
It's those other guys who did that. I try not to think about it.
You worked on the Capri back then? The Capri?
Yes, over in Europe I did.
Right,
yes.
Right, the European
right.
Capri.
Right, yes, absolutely. Yeah.
That was a cool
I would mention that anytime anybody mentions a Mustang.
Yeah. But I think then the second generation Capri, I had a black JPS special over there, which was really a cool car.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay, here's another one. 007 Mitch W. says, this isn't a trick question, he says. How is it that some cars just look great, like the 61 Continental or Volvo Amazon? I don't know that one.
Oh, no.
Anyway, he says, these are unlikely lookers. What is it about? I think you got to it before. What is it that when you look at a car, you just go, wow, that is so good?
I call it, a car has to have that ingredient X, that emotion that the people look at and they say, I don't have to have it, I want it. And that's something it starts with proportion, but then great surface development. You have to understand line, form, shape, details, graphics, and when all of those items come together,
then it's magic.
Then it is, and it's that magic that the designer has to put in the car to make it work.
Amazon was a P144, I think, wasn't it? I think that was
it?
Really?
Okay. Yeah, I've never heard it referred to as the Amazon.
I see a couple different, it's one of those deals where there are different names depending on where it was sold or trim level or whatever.
Goggle says, okay, new question for Mr. Telnak. Is it overkill for the big three to all go retro with their pony cars? Of course, the designers of those cars would say they're not retro.
Although it had nothing to do with the latest Mustang or the Camaro. I don't think they're that retro, really. I think they're evolutionary, and they're picking up design cues from the originals. And I think Camaro did a great job with it. And I think the Mustang is, you can tell it. This is important because you can really
100
tell
yards away, you know.
You know a Camaro and you know a Mustang. That's always right.
Challenger, too.
Absolutely.
Same
yes.
thing.
Yes.
Hey, we got a bunch of phone calls coming in. Ben, let's get to the first one of them.
Hi, this is Austin from Greenville, South Carolina. I just wanted to ask your guest today is if the Ford Start concept shown in China will show off Ford's new design strategy for the world. I noticed that the 2013 Taurus has a similar front end grafted on this time, so I was just wondering. Thank you. Bye.
Are you familiar with that concept
very
car?
Very definitely, yes. As a matter of fact, I sat in it here before it went to China to the show.
You get over to Ford a lot then.
Whether they want me to or not. Yeah, I can't keep my nose out of it.
That's cool.
But Jay's been very good about it, too, and inviting me in and to see. We have meetings there periodically. But, I think the cleanliness of the car will be adapted to a number of the models that they're doing. But that
here it is up on the screen right now.
Okay, yeah. And I think the very clean roof on it, the fast DLO, will have a strong influence on a number of the Ford products coming up. This is probably cleaner than a lot of the things we have today, too. Very simple shapes.
And what I loved about this car is this is where they showed off the three-cylinder engine for the first time, which I'm intrigued by.
Yeah. And again, look at that wheel. Look at the wheel in proportion to the body. And all. It's very good. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, Ben, let's bring in another phoner.
I was just Dan Smith, Durham, North Carolina. It seems to me as though a very high percentage of Mr. Telnak's project cars or concepts simply got aced out or canned. What's the deal? Ford like leaves an awful lot of their stuff on the table or sends it to the crusher. A lot of their concepts were really cool and never went into production. What's up?
Yeah, what's the deal?
Great question, yeah.
You're still scratching your head over that, too, huh?
I was asking that same question throughout my whole career in the Ford Motor Company. What's up? Why aren't we doing these cars? Because I think, strangely enough, I think we had a strong influence on some of our competitors and some of the cars that they did after we worked on it. As a matter of fact, we had one of the hottest concept cars I think we did at our Ghia studio in Turin, Italy, was the Focus. It had nothing to do with the Ford Focus on the road, but that's where the name came from. Mm-hmm. It was a little two-seater, and I think that had a strong influence on the Porsche
Boxster.
No question about it. Oh, yeah, because we were out about 2 years before the Boxster came out, and I was talking to Lapine.
Pininfarina?
No. The Porsche designer at the time.
Oh, it's Maurer now, right?
Yeah,
but before him.
Yeah. Anyway, and because we had the center exhaust coming out of it and all, and really, I think.
That rings a bell. Yeah, I seem to remember that car.
Yeah,
now.
We had little Nerf bars around instead of bumpers on the thing, and there's little dot taillights on it and all. But the basic shape and the silver car, even the color of the interior, I think was picked up by the box. You can't say they're stealing or anything like that. We're all influenced by everything we see, but we did it. We did a concept, and they did the real car. You know, more power to them. They did it. But and I think another car we did that we introduced at the Geneva show was a fastback Aston Martin Lagana Vignale. I don't know if you remember that one. The name was longer than the car.
Mm-hmm.
And I can still remember Bob Lutz walking up to me behind me in the show. He was with already with Chrysler at the time. And he said, that is such a blah, 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 great car. And I said, yeah, I agree. And it wasn't long after that that the Maybach came out and had some of those features on it. And I was kicking myself saying, why didn't I push harder in the company? I've said that to myself many times in the company. Why didn't I push harder? I still dream about design and thinking I should have pushed harder for a number of these cars that didn't quite make it there, but especially the concept cars. Good question.
Yeah, that is a good one. And that's always got to be a tension of, you know, you can really push the envelope with a concept car.
Sure.
But, you know, even if management gives it an okay, it's like 3 to 4 years away before it shows up.
Exactly, yeah. And that's always, the lead time on this is just incredible. It's not like the 18 months when we used to do cars back in the 60s.
That's right.
Unfortunately.
But I mean, we host a design competition at CCS every year, and we have top designers come in and talk to the student designers as they present their awards. And that just reminded me because a couple of the designers spoke up to the students and said, you have to sell your idea.
Absolutely.
Speak up.
Mm.
Yes. Sell your idea. Yes. Because they said, once you get your real job, you have to. You really have to. It may be the best design in the world. You have
if
to
you
sell it.
Sell it. You're right. Absolutely right.
Well, I know Rick Rogers, who runs all of CCS, has said
yes.
that. That's one of the things they're trying to emphasize because, you know, he told me designers tend to be artists. They tend to be introverts. You know, it's like, yeah. I did this great work, but I'm just going to be
yeah,
here in the
right.
corner.
I hope you like it.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
You got to sell your ideas. You got to
no
sell
question.
Yourself.
Great point. Yes.
So.
Yeah.
So, of course, is that why some designers turn into egomaniacs, though?
Yeah, right. Yeah, once they start believing.
We're not talking
yeah.
about you, Jack.
Okay,
honest or not.
Okay,
I'm
yeah.
honest.
I clarified that.
No, there seem to be so many rock stars since, you know, since maybe 2000. Maybe that's part of the push is they're teaching designers to do that so the designer is often the guy who comes out and describes
they're it. Really featuring yeah. it much more than they ever have before. Yeah,
yeah.
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 I was the only rock star in my day.
Of course.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, we got another phone call here, Matt. Let's bring it in.
Hi, John. This is Cecil from Bird in Hand, Pennsylvania. I'm wondering, with the fuel economy standard being sort of forced on the people, why doesn't the government just raise the gas tax, like Bob Lutz was saying on your show earlier, which would also, as a side benefit, help fund roads and bridges? Thanks. Bye-bye.
Well, I've been preaching that for so many years, like so many other people. It ain't going to happen.
Turn on cable TV.
Yeah,
you'll
yeah.
find out.
Tax is a four-letter
yeah.
word in one.
Yeah, I mean,
any politician that proposes raising taxes, we, the American people, will throw them out on their ear. It's the smart way to do things. That's how the rest of the world does it.
The entire rest of the industrial
and,
world. Yeah.
You know, up until Europe introduced its CO2 standards, it had no fuel economy requirement. Mm-hmm. And to your point earlier, Drew, if it's $8 a gallon, you don't need the government breathing down
yeah.
your neck to say you should go out and buy something fuel efficient.
Yeah.
You don't need that.
Yeah.
So it's it isn't going to happen,
no.
I don't think.
No.
So... let's see. Do we have any more questions here? What car? Here's a great one. What car did Mr. Telnak wish that Ford put into production that he had sketched?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah. They put most of them in. Most of the ones that I worked on were in production, but I didn't have one that really.
No concept cars that...
concept cars...
That could have been produced?
Well, sure, yeah. I think going back to that Focus that we...
Yeah.
Focus two-seater that we did
right.
at GIA, that would have been a great car. And I'm sure it would have sold, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's probably one of the hottest ones we had.
And I think we've got another one, another phone call here. Ben, let's bring that one in.
Jack, great program. John, great program. The question I have for you is regarding styling. Why is the greenhouse continuing to shrink when you compare current cars to, let's say, a 60s or early 70s BMW 2002? Yeah. The greenhouse has continued to shrink. Visibility has decreased. What can be done in styling or safety issues to bring the wide, large greenhouse back? Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. I'm glad you asked. When you say shrink, I'm assuming you're talking about height. The glass
yeah, like
coming
the first generation Chrysler 300.
Yes. Yeah. Right.
But he's like he's right. You know, yeah. you look at a BMW 2002. It looks like a fishbowl. You
yeah.
know, the greenhouse
yeah.
area compared to today's car.
I think those Ford Sunliners had a similar kind of greenhouse to the 2002.
Sure.
Obviously a fastback, but I mean the same sort of. Very yeah. light, thin A and B and C pillars.
Well, I think it's strictly a trend, and I believe that back when BMW was doing that, and I always liked the BMW, the 630, the coupe way back,
yeah.
Which was a very high greenhouse, low belt, and I used to instruct the guys back here in Michigan too when we worked on one of the T-Birds. Give me a low belt and give me a high greenhouse. That is the look I was really trying to achieve. And then all of a sudden, the whole trend shifted. And I think Chrysler had a lot to do with that with the 300
yeah.
by raising the belt. The roof stayed the same. The height of the greenhouse is the same. It's just that the belt came up, really.
Yeah.
Although they've lowered it in the current car.
They have, yeah. The new standard, has the belt actually come down?
Well, I don't know if the belt's come down, but the glass does not look as cheated as before.
You're right, yeah. And I always felt that was kind of a Dick Tracy look. Remember the Dick Tracy cartoons very low greenhouse? And I wasn't really a great fan of that.
BMW could never do the 2002 again for roof crush standards. Again, it comes back to
and
that.
And I think that's the side impact standard.
Yeah.
If you just took today's cars and shrunk the size of the A pillars, B, and even the sail panels down to what they were back when, the greenhouse would look a whole lot bigger now.
Yeah, but you can't meet it.
So
we're really restricted on that because of government regulations.
Because the only one I think by a Mini Cooper, I mean, they're the only ones that I can think of that still have a big, tall greenhouse.
They still do, yeah.
But we drive so many cars these days that have the very thick A pillars, and they're good for crush, but you can't see around them quite.
No, not only that.
Yeah, we did that. We've got that. That's our cover story coming up, and it's we already did it online. That's it.
Yeah, you did. Yeah. In fact, we covered that in the Daily Show. There's a second point to it, too. Mm-hmm. Not only are the pillars so big, they're now made out of this boron, high-strength steel that the jaws of life can't cut through. So now if you get special brand-new jaws of life, you can do it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you look at every municipality and state and county going broke right now, who's got the money to run out and buy all new equipment?
Oh.
So it's crazy to me that, you know, we've done these roof crush standards, and I don't mean to belittle the lives that they're going to save, but it's like 80 lives is what NHTSA estimates that this is going to sell. But how many accidents are your lack of visibility going to cause? You know, what about people who do get in a crush situation and the emergency personnel can't cut them out of the car because they can't cut through this boron steel? It's nuts. There, I'll get off my soapbox. Hey, look, it's at the top of the hour. We ought to wrap this up here. But Jack Telnack, it's been awesome, man.
Oh,
this has been terrific.
This has been great.
I can't believe the time went so fast.
Really,
yeah, Drew Winter from Ward's Auto World, great having you here as always, and Todd Lassa as well.
Thanks.
And I've got a few other announcements to make here. Remember, the podcast of this is going to be available tomorrow. Don't forget Open Line. You can get the podcast version of that. Great discussion show that we also do. You can go to bit.ly/openpodcast, and you'll get that all there. And folks, you know, we've got some great sponsors of the show. Show your support to them for having shown support to us. Go and click on their ads on our website. They like to know that people are really paying attention to the fact that they're advertising here. And don't forget that you can friend us on Facebook. You can follow us at twitter.com/autoline. I'll give Peter DeLorenzo, my co-host, a plug, even though he's not here tonight. Follow his stuff at autoextremist.com. And thanks for having tuned in, folks. We'll see you back here next week.
Visit our website, AutolineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with Autoline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at AutolineDetroit.tv.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.